Hi, this is Scott Hancock, and you're listening to the Sirens of Audio. G'day audiophiles, you're listening to the Sirens of Audio, the podcast devoted to Doctor Who and the audio medium. Today we'll be reviewing the Big Finish release Masterful, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first appearance of the Master in 1971's Terror of the Autons. I'm your host Dwayne, and joining me because he will obey me is Philip. G'day.
Yeah, hello Dwayne. I'm not sure I'll do that, but yes. Thanks. Good to be here.
Okay, a bit of news for the podcast first. We're our main show is always going to be audio based. We're always going to be an audio podcast, but we've gone video as well. Our last show had some nice responses. So I've gone and set up a channel, Philip, and so please subscribe to our channel. Just do a search on YouTube for the Sirens of Audio. You'll find it there. Whether we put up every episode or not, don't know yet. It's still brand new. But there could be extra goodies like bloopers and things. We don't do bloopers, do we, Philip?
No, we never make mistakes. Never made a mistake the whole time we've been doing this, Dwayne.
Yeah, and I hope you subscribe too, Philip.
Yeah, so I will. Now I know it's happening. You've just developed this.
I wanted to discuss it with you, and that was our discussion.
Yeah, great. I will obey.
All right. Thank you. As a bonus feature for this episode, stick around after the end credits for a short story. It's written and read by me. I'm very scared. It's a Seventh Doctor story called Perception Filter. Goes for about 35 minutes. And even Philip thought it was okay. But you haven't heard it yet, Philip, so you may reserve judgment.
Oh, that's okay. I didn't know you were planning to publish it that soon. I might have made a few more edits if I'd done that.
That was another discussion that we just had. So very good. That's good. All right, it's time to jump down that rabbit hole, Philip. Let's go.
Oh, no.
Now, I've been looking at our listener demographics, and our largest age group of listeners is the 45 to 59 age group, followed by the 35 to 44-year-old age group. And I want to know what your thoughts are on this. Do you think this is reflective of Big Finish listenership in general?
I think it certainly shows a very discerning age group of people. People who are
That's
wise.
A very diplomatic way to put
people
it.
People who are wise and sensible and no good thing. I'd be very curious to know if that is the general demographic of Big Finish. I don't know. In some ways, it makes sense just in terms of cash. Big Finish, they're wonderful value, but you need to be able to have the money for it. And I suspect that for younger people, it might be a bit hard. I certainly play a lot of Big Finish to my kids, but they don't pay for it. I guess it might be reflective of that. It might be reflective of people who listen to podcasts as well. I've not thought about it much.
You've got a few kids to choose from, but is there any of your kids that particularly like it, or do they all like it? Do the older ones like it? What's the story with your younger kids?
The oldest three are probably the most into Doctor Who. They're sort of the ones I took on the journey the most. I've been trying, my 10-year-old, I've been trying to infect, but he's at the moment not really that interested. So we watched nearly the whole first season of Eccleston but he listens to some stories in the car with me because he has no choice. So but
he probably thinks the Ecclestons are really old-fashioned and bad special effects.
He's actually huge into Harry Potter, and those special effects are certainly no better now. You look back at the first few films and you think the special effects were accepted. I try and teach our kids. I mean, we watch a lot of musicals, we watch a lot of movies, old movies, so they're fairly used to an eclectic range of viewing. And so I don't think they always expect the best. I don't think that's realistic. I mean, yeah, give me wobbly sets over bad scripts any day.
So I do know that we do have younger listeners to the podcast at the very least. So if you are a Big Finish fan and you're under that age 35, what I would recommend is you tell as many of your friends as you can that there is plenty of free audio drama to listen to from Big Finish on Spotify. Lots and lots of different, not just Doctor Who, there's other spin-offs as well. So have a listen to those, recommend them, get more people coming in of a younger age so that we can keep Big Finish going for many, many years to come. Yeah.
Yep.
So your older kids, they get right into them, do they?
They have phases. So sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But yeah, most of them now and then. I mean, in terms of Big Finish, I'm the Big Finish fan. I mean, I've watched all the TV shows through with my sons. So we've gone from, Unearthly Child all the way through. But that being said, yeah, Rachel's the one that got up with me early on New Year's Day to watch special. So she's our eldest. So it they go in different phases at different times. What about your kids? Do they watch or listen to anything?
I have a wife who doesn't like Doctor Who at all, and some friends who don't like it at all, so I'm pretty much on my own. Although when they go driving with me alone in the car, they're trapped. They can't go anywhere. So I was driving around with them today listening to Masterful, and they were being surprisingly good for me for a change. They're very, very young though, so I've still got time. There's still time.
I've got a wife who she does a bit more than tolerates it. She comes and watches all the shows with me. She's pretty good that way. I don't think I had certainly kept my level of Doctor Who interest hidden while we were going out. So I think
Sneaky,
she was
sneaky.
certainly a bit surprised after we got married and suddenly my video collection came out and my book collection came out and a few other things. She kind of knew I liked it, but I don't think she had any clue of the level of how much I liked it. I think she still just sort of shakes her head and goes, "Oh dear."
Yes, my wife was exactly the same. Exactly the same. Poor thing. All right, I think it's time to drag ourselves out of this rabbit hole and get into Masterful.
I presume you summoned me.
To a ruined castle on a desolate rock? Hardly my style.
From Big Finish Productions.
You may have wondered why I called you here today.
To a ruined castle carved from obsidian, decorated with black marble, black drapes, one senses a theme.
It's because one of you in this room is a murderer. And it's me!
Masterful.
Ah. My dear master, 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 and master. This is a very great and, may I say, unexpected pleasure.
We've never done this before. Got together, had a chin wag, swapped evil schemes.
Yes, a knees up. And it's not just to cheer up, you sad sops. No, it's to gloat. Why? Lean in. No, lean closer.
The doctor is dead.
Well, I'm going to fight back, and I won't ever give up.
Look your master in the eye.
The thing is, someone, naming no names, but hint, hint, gloaty McGloatface over there, forgot to invite me. So, I am gatecrashing.
You're a beautiful woman, improbably.
I'm the master, and you will obey me.
Your cute little frowny frowns. The seven dwarfs. Schemey, 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 and crispy. That's you, barbecue.
Look out there. Planet may not be much, but the sunset's to die for. All those stars, mine. All the planets spinning around them, mine too. All creation bows down and worships me. I am finally the master.
The universe hangs in the balance.
Boom.
Pure raging evil.
I've come from another dimension. The stars are going out in my universe, and the threat comes from this one.
Miss Grant, listen. 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 We're all the master.
We're all the master!
Big Finish. We love stories.
My name is Kitty.
Pleased to meet you, Kitty.
I'm pausing, waiting to hear yours.
It is, I am generally referred to as
The...
Yes?
Would you believe Jeremy?
Okay, so Philip, we're going to do a spoiler section tonight. We're going to talk about aspects of it, but to start off, we'll do a non-spoiler section, get some initial thoughts. What were your initial thoughts on Masterful?
When it was first announced, I thought it was fantastic. So I was pretty excited by the whole idea. I love multi-doctor stories. They're up among my favourite. And you know, sometimes people say they're not as good a quality. I still think three doctors and five doctors are superb. Two doctors is probably my favourite, Colin Baker. So I love the multi-doctor stories. And I've loved the multi-doctor stories that Big Finish have done. So I thought when they announced they were going to do a multi-master story, I thought, great. The you know, a couple of times they've dipped their toes in earlier. There's a McQueen and Beavers multiple story from a couple of years back, which is absolutely brilliant by John Dorney. So, yeah, I was pretty excited when I heard it was happening. And, of course, for the 50th anniversary of The Master, absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, it's epic. And, yeah, when I first listened to it, I was pretty excited. What did you think?
Yeah, and we had a taste a few months back of John Coleshaw as the Delgado and Ainley Masters in those short trips in the Time Lord Victorious set. We've also heard the Five Doctors audio, so we know what he can do. So I was very excited about that as well. So overall, my impression was I just loved the dialogue. It's written by James Goss, so he's a very competent writer, very accomplished. He's in charge of Time Lord Victorious. So I knew this was in safe hands. But with how many masters is there altogether? Nine masters, if you include
the Ainley
master. And we'll go into further as to why we say that in the spoiler zone. The question is, how does that work? I do love those multi-doctor stories on TV, and even when Big Finish has done them from time to time, but they do have a tendency to potentially be a little bit convoluted, a little bit confusing. So it's just what happens when you're trying to. It's an unusual concept. All these different characters being the same character. What do you do with them? So, I was very excited. But overall, I really enjoyed this. The banter between them all, because there are scenes when they're all together. There are some scenes when they split off and are in pairs. Some when they're on their own. And some with Katie Manning as well, because Joe Grant's in this story too. Because let's not forget, not only is this the Master's 50th anniversary, it's Joe Grant's 50th anniversary. It's 50 years since she appeared in the TV show as well, so it was good to have her in there.
Now, that was a surprise for me. Did you know, had it been announced that Katie Manning was in it? Because I started listening and suddenly Joe was there, and I hadn't, because I deliberately don't look at cast lists beforehand. I try not to be spoiled. Had it been announced that Katie was going to be in it?
I think so. I think I'd heard some trailers, but maybe more recently. So the whole Masterful set was announced so long ago, and so much has happened since then that I hadn't been thinking about it for most of 2020. So it was being released this month. It was all quite new. So it was certainly something that I didn't expect, that's for sure. But I'm pretty sure it was announced.
Okay, I certainly was surprised by that, which was, you know, it was a great surprise. But I don't know why it hadn't crossed my radar. As I said, I deliberately don't look too much. I don't look at cast lists before we start. I deliberately don't. I actually don't usually read the synopsis. I had done for this one, but I usually don't even read on the Big Finish website too much. Well, you know, I often don't read what the story's about, because I do like to hit them fresh. I do think it was a great way to start the year with something big and epic. And I think Big Finish was a great idea for them to have these moments. And this is certainly a standalone moment of hugeness. So it was certainly a very clever way of kicking off the year, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you and I have both purchased the limited edition set. So in addition to this story, there were three other stories involving the Master. Two of them were short trips, which had previously been released. I Am the Master, written by Jeffrey Beavers, which was a fantastic story. And The Shifting, written by Simon Gurrier. They were both included on a single disc and very enjoyable. But the new story that was written specifically for John Coleshaw, and focusing on the Third Doctor era and the UNIT era was Terror of the Master. I think it actually the runtime of Terror of the Master is longer than Masterful because it's an audio book. It's read as an audio book, well, written and read by John Coleshaw as an audio book, and he does all the voices. And this was the big surprise for me because I don't remember hearing anything about this. And it was a delight from start to finish. That's all I can say about that. What about you, Philip?
I kept forgetting it wasn't a full cast audio because with Third Doctor voice, Brigadier, even Yates and Benton were clearly, and then, of course, Delgado Master. So we had five voices where you really couldn't tell it wasn't them.
Yeah.
So it was so, yeah, it was, I think actually the cover is performed by, it's not read by, they've used a different term on the cover, which I thought was more appropriate. I think it might be performed by John Coleshaw because it certainly is a performance. And it felt like a full cast. Audios can sometimes, I can tune out and I've got to be focused in on them or I can vague out and start thinking about other things. But this actually kept my attention the whole time. My thinking didn't wander at all, even though it was quite a long book.
Yeah, absolutely. It had me smiling with happiness throughout, with all the different shout-outs to that previous era, because this was my era. The Third Doctor era was the one that I grew up on, basically. It was early 80s, early to mid-80s, lots of Jon Pertwee on TV in Australia, and so he was my doctor. And this was just perfect. I love this particular story. So I think maybe it's time to get out of the spoiler-free zone. What do you reckon, Philip?
Yep, okay, sounds good.
Okay, let's talk about Masterful. And I think the premise of Masterful was great. It's about all the Masters being summoned to a mysterious location for a party, basically. And all of the Masters, after the opening, all turning up in this location, wondering who made the invitation in the first place. I think it was a great premise, lots of great snappy dialogue, and fantastic. I was thinking all the way through, why didn't they include the Delgado Master? But I hadn't heard Terror of the Master by then. But it comes, you know, that question is raised then. There's so many Masters there. Can we do justice to them all if we add another one?
I thought, it's interesting that usually with most multi-doctor stories, what tends to happen is you have individual stories of the Doctors and at the very end they meet up. And it's not usually the very end that they're actually all together. Whereas with this one, you actually had the beginning was all the Masters together. And that was actually the only time the majority of them were there. So towards the end, most of them come back, but not all of them come back. But you do have most, still not all of them, most of them at the very beginning. And I do think just the way they introduced them one by one. You talked before about the same character. I think one of the things that came clear for me watching this was the fact that actually the Master is very different. And the different way that they're portrayed and also the experiences are different. So in many ways, you know, the War Master is actually the most successful of all of them. And certainly if you listen to the War Master sets, he actually wins more than he loses. Whereas, you know, the Delgado Master, the Ainsley Master, the John Sims Master, they always lost. You know, every time they try to some plot or something, they always lose. Whereas the War Master, part of the reason why the War Master is so frustrating and so dreadful is he always wins. But more often than not, it's actually him succeeding. So he was very much the successful Master, and you still had the other Masters playing against type. You know, the Beavers Master, you know, who's the oldest actor there in terms of having held the role for so long, and is probably the most used amongst Big Finish. I mean, he's always dealing with his pain and his suffering and his form. So I actually thought they differentiated their characters quite well throughout and actually tried to emphasize different characteristics by the actors. And what a, I mean, what a cast, for goodness sake. I can't believe you could get so many amazing top-notch actors in one place.
Yeah, that particularly that opening half hour or so was just incredible, the way all the dialogue worked between them all. It was just beautiful to listen to. The only master that wasn't there was the Unbound master, played by Mark Gatiss. He comes in later. He wasn't there right at the beginning.
Was the McQueen one there?
Yeah, he was there.
Okay. There were actually levels in which, because there were so many present, I had some trouble distinguishing voices. So the McQueen and the Sim, two voices, I struggled to differentiate who was who. And that's actually one of the weaknesses I'd actually put down, was I think in terms of the one who least got himself in terms of the old style was actually John Sim. So, because, you know, in the TV show, he's quite mad, quite manic, and he was much more subdued. And I guess in part when he came back in the Capaldi story at the end, he was a bit more subdued. But I struggled to really get his characteristic through there. So I thought he was probably the one that in some ways faded the most and wasn't quite as insane as he should have been.
Well, I guess in terms of audio, he's the least experienced apart from the young master, played by Milo
Parker.
Milo Parker. So I don't think he'd done any audio before, but yeah, John Sim, I don't think he'd played the master on audio either. So whereas all the others had. So perhaps that was a factor. Perhaps he was feeling a little bit dwarfed by the monolith that is Derek Jacobi. Because I do remember. No, hang on. There was a part in the extras where. That's right. They were talking about the TV series, and they'd never actually met in Utopia when the War Master regenerated into the Saxon Master. And yeah, John Sim was disappointed by that. So he was very happy to be working with Derek Jacobi on this, and they were teamed up as a couple in the story, really good.
I do think when the two of them were just together, just the two of them, it worked a lot better because it was a bit more contained. I guess part of the issue might be too, I mean, it'd be fascinating to know, looking at the extras afterwards or looking at the box afterwards, there's, I think, four or five different studios this has been recorded in. So this is recorded 2019. So it was recorded a long time ago. This has been sitting there for, you know, almost a year and a half waiting to come out. So interesting how far ahead Big Finish is often working. I mean, we're getting a lot of stuff out coming out now, which, you know, has been done in the last couple of months. You know, David Tennant's free, suddenly they write scripts and bang, we've got it. But this was being in the pipeline long, long ago, recorded September 19. And I suspect may have been recorded in lots of different places at different times. So I don't know how many of them were together. From the extras, it sounds like Jacobi and Sim were in the studio together, doing all their stuff, but it's quite possible that they weren't with anybody else for any other scene. And so it must be very hard toning your performance at the right level when you're not actually in the studio with the other actors. And so possibly had John Sim been there, seen the other performances, seen how big they were, he may have found it was a bit easier to tune in. So I don't know if that's the case. I'd be fascinated to know the background to that. But I do think it must be very, very hard for actors to only have lines being read into them and not actually being able to bounce off the performance.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of when they were split, let's talk about the story, because there's been some comments that I've seen online about the story. It's a very long story. It's a 3-hour story, which it kind of has to be if you've got that many characters to serve them and to serve justice to them. It's got to be that long. But it kind of, you and I were talking before we came on, and we're still a little bit confused about the story. We sort of kind of, it's kind of dangling there in our heads, sort of teasing us, saying, here's the story. And then we try and think about it and then it disappears again. Did the story work for you?
I do think it was a bold way of telling a story, and I appreciate the fact that it's been told differently. So it's always interesting to see how different writers approach the Moti Doctor stories. And in the last big celebration for the 20 years of Big Finish, of course, each Doctor had their own individual story with particular companions. And then at the very end of however many it was, five or six, it was a big thing. But each story was self-contained for a Doctor with a companion and a baddie. And then at the very end, they pulled it all together. This one tried to do something differently. It started with them all together. It then scatters them all. And then they have the individual stories. But rather than, you know, just focusing on one story and then the next story, it is bouncing back and forth between all the Masters and the people they're meeting. So you have a disc and a half of just constantly moving back and forth, moving back and forth. And then at the very end, they come back together again to sort of wrap it up. So I appreciate the fact that they've actually done a very different style. It's a difficult style, and it is harder work because of the way they've done it. And I've heard, you know, I've been reading some stuff on the Twitter and other places that have criticized the fact that they thought, you know, it would have been better just to give each Master their own disc. But I actually appreciate the fact that they've tried to make an epic tale and tell it differently. And the thing I always appreciate most is about the Big Finish stories, the good ones, is that they do actually go out on a limb and try something different. Doesn't always work, not always the best, but the fact that they keep trying new things. And on the whole, this works. It's engaging all the way through. There's, you know, particular stories I wanted to keep going back to because there was a couple of Master stories which were the ones that were intriguing me the most. I have listened to a second time. I listened to it all again today. And there were actually different stories that I wanted to focus on more than last time. So, yeah, it gave extra value because I wanted to listen to it differently this time. Do you think the whole thing worked? Yeah.
To be honest, I think it did. I'm sure there are a dozen different ways you could do it. But I think it's interesting enough. I think there's enough scope given to these actors to play off each other. I was probably a little bit disappointed with the time that Eric Roberts' Master was in there. He's a surprising Master for me. We've had him once or twice before in Big Finish. And after this release, I'm really excited about his box set that's coming out. I can't wait for that. That's going to be great. I like this Master a lot.
Well, he's hate him, but that's what I'm supposed to do. He's evil. and it's interesting that he does probably the most wicked thing. To me, he does the most wicked thing of any of the Masters.
And he does it to himself.
And he does it to himself. He's just awful.
He's a sadist.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing the Master box set. I think that comes out next month, does it? Or is it March?
I'm not sure. But he's
sometime over the next couple of months.
He's just, once again, he has the most amazingly beautiful, rich voice, malevolent. He's just fantastic. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to the box set that's coming out. I suspect that once again, it would be lovely to have had him in more, but I suspect he's in LA, having to do a studio in LA. They're probably better now. I think COVID and doing lockdown recording, they're learning better now how to do the distance stuff. But that was still fairly early on. They were doing some stuff with John Barrowman over there and a few other people. But I think they're getting better now and the productions are more seamless long distance.
Yeah. Yeah, there are actually three directors for this. Ken Bentley is the main director, but Jason Hay-Yellery directed Eric Roberts.
Yep.
And Scott Hancock directed Mark Gatiss.
I didn't know that. Scenes.
Yeah, so... Yeah, a couple of other directors involved as well.
So when you're dealing with these big names, the fact that you can actually nail them down to a date is hard work. And so no wonder all their timings conflicted with both directors and each other. And yeah, these are some big, big names.
Another Master that I was really excited about, because obviously Jeffrey Beavers, he does a lot. So there's a lot of material by him out there. So it's always wonderful to hear his voice. However, I think Alex McQueen's been missing over the last few years more than he should. And I hope that he comes back for more because he's fantastic as the Master. I adore his Master. I've always said that I'd love to see him on TV. I don't know why they put him on TV. And interestingly, in the extras, Alex himself says that his characterization of the Master is much better suited to audio, because he's in audio, you've got more scope to go over the top and put all that operatic style into your voice, which he does. Whereas on TV, you can't quite do that as much. So I thought that was an interesting take of his, that he thinks he's more suited for audio than TV. But I'd still love to see him on TV.
He probably recorded that before he saw Sacha Dhawan's performance, because that's totally over the top. So sometimes you can do it.
Well, I thought John Sim was quite over the top too. But anyway.
Yep. So,
what were your thoughts on Katie Manning's portrayal throughout the story? Because she ended up being paired up with a couple of different characters throughout.
Yes, it was wonderful to hear Katie there, and it was amusing how she managed to arrive. Because in terms of why was she there with all the masters? And you see, we won't spoil everything. We don't need to, because I'm sure there's some people listening to this who haven't listened yet. But her arrival was a very funny arrival, and then what happened to her next was amusing. I loved how she. I mean, I thought she was paired up really well with the Ainley Master. Once again, there's a story behind that. But I do think her and Missy actually did work well together. It's interesting that you've only got a couple of females in the cast and you decide to pair them together. But in one sense, there's a level which they're both in love with the Doctor. Both Missy and Joe are both, not romantically or so, but in terms of Missy trying to learn humanity. And so, I mean, I get the feeling this was during the Peter Capaldi later era. Well, I guess it's where there's Missy's there, but during her part of her journey to find, can she become nice?
Yeah, I actually see this as the forerunner to Series 10 and the Missy story in Series 10.
Yeah, quite possibly. But it was interesting that, because Missy was exploring what does it mean to be human, what does it mean to be nice, and there's no nicer person than Jo Grant, and so she was the perfect foil in terms of how do you learn to be nice, and how do you use nice as a weapon? Because I guess Jo knows how to manipulate people in a nice way through her niceness. So I think that was a good choice. And I think Missy starting to learn to be nice then frightened her. Leads to doing something pretty awful. But it was a part of it, just trying to examine, understand what that means, understand why the Doctor bothers with a companion. She gave away some clever little tricks that the Doctor does to make the companion feel important. There's a scene in a library and helping Joe find the answer, and showing that the Doctor actually really tricks you into finding the answer, you don't really find it, which I thought was amusing. I'm not sure how true that is, but it's just Missy being nasty. But the two of them bounce off really well together. And just like Joe Grant, Katie is one of the loveliest people in the whole world. It's hard to find anyone nicer than her. If you follow Katie on Twitter, she's just there to be encouraging and supportive and to call out to her fans all the time and make you feel warm and fuzzy inside.
Yeah. Yeah, she's lovely.
What did you think of the young master, Dwayne? Marlo Parker's version. He's a new master they've brought on the scene for the first time.
I didn't think he had that much to do, really. I wasn't quite sure why he was there. I didn't, unless I missed it. I could have missed it. I could have been distracted, but not sure why. Is it the same master that we saw look into the schism? So still in that early.
I suppose it is the same master, isn't it? That's the costume he's wearing. He's wearing that costume.
Of course,
And the implication is he's still on Gallifrey and learning how to be evil. So he hasn't yet left Gallifrey. He's still watching. He's obviously has killed, but he doesn't kill for pleasure. He kills for if it's important. So they started to do a bit of character development in terms of why the master went bad. And there's levels at which he looks at some of his other selves. He's quite shocked by what he's going to become. And he's wondering about...
He's disgusted, I would have thought.
Yeah, is this really the path I want to take? But then he still does things that makes you realise, he has no empathy. He allows someone to go. You know, he does kind of warn someone about if you keep going, you'll be dead, but doesn't actually step in enough to stop it or be forceful enough to stop it. He allows, you know, that character to still go off to his death. So there is an apathy there towards human life, which I guess you will develop later on in further Masters.
A bit like the Rani, I suppose.
Yeah, possibly. I actually partly wonder, maybe the role was actually written for a different Master who they decided not to use, and so recast a slightly younger version.
Yeah, potentially. Who knows? In terms of John Coleshaw and his role in this story, he is credited as Chameleon. So he would be playing the Ailey Master, but if you look at the credits, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the Ailey Master is Chameleon. But what's good about Chameleon is that he can change into other faces as well, and there's a really nice surprise that we get through Chameleon as well, which is really nice, adds to the story. He's a funny role, that Chameleon. I don't know. I'm not quite sure where he came from in the story, but he's there. He's there.
Well, he's there because he's working for Missy. So Missy has picked him up from somewhere and she's been using him. So that's why he's there. And it's her slave that she's using and controlling him.
Yeah.
So that's why he's there. I mean, it was partly a choice in terms of maybe they were concerned that John Coleshaw couldn't be convincing enough as the Master. And so if I make it Chameleon who's pretending to be the Master, if you're concerned about the voice not being quite right, which I actually think it's pretty spot on, you can always say, oh, it's because it's Chameleon. It's not really the Master. It's not really Anthony Ainley. But that's to let those hard-hearted people out there who don't like John Coleshaw's performance, and there's a few out there. I think, yeah, you can always say, you know, for those people to say, well, it's really Chameleon, so that's okay.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. So I think this is a good celebration, a worthy celebration of 50 years of the Master. I think it's very good. Was there anything you wanted to say about the story of Masterful before we move on to Terror of the Master?
Just looking at my notes here. I really love the fact that they actually had the Master in a silly disguise at the beginning. So when Missy enters, you know, she's dressed up in a different disguise, different voice, using the name that the wizard doctor using the demons as her nom de plume. I thought it was, yeah, if you have a Master story, you're going to have at least one of them dressed up for no apparent reason whatsoever, because that's what the Master does.
Yeah.
I had the Jacoby Beavers and Roberts in particular nailed their characters, which was just great. I enjoyed the music throughout and the sound design. Joe Kramer did the sound design, the music, and as always, just spectacular and lots of bangs and really moody music and stunning music. He has done probably some of my favorite title sequences. So he does the theme songs for the robots, for the Paternoster Gang, Missy, Rose Tyler, Transference, and Jenny, all of which I think are amazing theme tunes. I wasn't quite as impressed by the theme tune for this. I couldn't quite work out that it happened. So with the two cliffhangers, suddenly music started, and I hadn't even picked up on the fact that that was actually the end of the episode, because it wasn't quite what I expected a Master theme to be, where the Master's scary.
It was subdued, wasn't it?
It was. And I guess it was in a minor key, so that's bad. but I guess it wasn't quite the theme I would have expected if you've got to write a theme for the Master. I would have expected something with a bit more fear, a bit more foreboding, a bit more militant maybe. So it really wasn't what I expected. Where the other themes I find, you know, the Paternoster Gang one is just spot on. It hits the period. You know exactly where you are at the start. The odd show has ended with a really downbeat ending. And then the happy theme comes in. I said, oh, they probably need a second ending theme for some of the episodes they have. But on the whole, the sound design, as always, is just spot on. Loved it. But it's the thing. So there's a few stories. If you push the plot a bit, you do have to try and struggle a bit in terms of how did it end, why did it end quite the way it did. There's a couple of reveals at the end I wasn't quite sure about, even on a second listen. But really, as a celebration of the Master, you couldn't do much better.
Absolutely. Speaking of a celebration of the Master, Terror of the Master is the story that was written by Trevor Baxendale, which it takes three discs of the limited edition. I think it's an 8-disc set. Yeah, 8 discs. Yeah. So we won't talk about the short trips today because you can get those short trips. And, I will say one thing. There's a concept within the Jeffrey Beavers short trip, I Am the Master. I just love it. There's a thing called an earworm that's put throughout the whole story, and I love that kind of storytelling. It was done in Sapphire and Steel as well, where it tries to, you know, break the fourth wall in a different sci-fi kind of way, which I find really good. But yeah, Terror of the Master, Trevor Baxendale, John Coleshaw. I think from it, if you're used to listening to full cast audio drama, this is quite different. So it's much, much more like an audio book, but it's the voices, it's the performance. Yeah, like you said before, Philip, it's the performance of John Coleshaw that makes this absolutely fantastic from start to finish. It's set after the Green Death and before the Time Warrior. So there is another character, another female companion type character in there that we get to know a little. And I think I've heard those voices, the Brigadier, the Third Doctor, the Master before, but I couldn't believe John Coleshaw even nailed Mike Yates and Benton. I could not believe it. And of course, speaking of anniversaries, this is the 50th anniversary of Mike Yates as well. Too. So, what were your in-depth thoughts on Terror of the Master? It's a much more simple story. Well, it's only got the one Doctor in it. It's only got the Master in it. So it's very similar to Season 8 and the Master stories set on Earth. For me, this took me right back to my childhood. Very nostalgia-filled for me.
Yeah, it was a traditional Master story in many ways, which I actually really loved. And you kind of knew where it was going, but that's part of why you liked it. There's some lovely throwaway lines because there's a report early on that the Brigadier is reading about the fact that scientists are going missing. And the Time War is going to be coming up soon. So it's the start of and there's another report about another side of the Loch Ness Monster. So there's just those two little throwaways, which are just beautiful throwaways because you know they're coming. They actually do really create the extra little companion really well, which has gives the episode a bit more punch. So yeah, it was a really good listen. Once again, there's a really strong sound design in it as well. There was actually a lot of sound effects, a lot of music. If you want to start learning how to listen to audiobooks, this is a good way into an audiobooks because it's so well produced. It's soundscaped, it's musicked, and John Coleshaw's playing lots of characters, and you're never lost with who you are. So yeah. It's a good way to start learning how to listen to audiobooks.
Very good. I think Steve Foxen does the sound on that one.
He did.
I think.
Yes. Yes, yeah. He did.
So, yeah, it took me way back. As I said, I was smiling at many places throughout. And we know the Roger Delgado Master it does disguises. So kind of thinking, yeah, that's got to be the Master. Or is it? Or isn't it? Not sure. They had a nice twist on the Master's disguises as well.
You would tick off the number of things that have been picked up, but doesn't sound reused. So you know the Doctor's watching television to advance the plot, and he sees something on the television screen. There's an alien involved. The Master. There's telepathy. There's masks. There's nuclear power stations. You start seeing Mike Yates goes a bit further in terms of pollution. So that's sort of been raised with him in The Green Death. It's going to come up a lot more in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. But you can see them taking that character a bit further in terms of pollution, and we have to look after this world, or it'll be gone in 50 years' time. So there's all these little, there's the little political stuff that's in there. There's still the Doctor being a bit nasty, because John Pertwee's Doctor could be a bit nasty at times, but then he also has, they gave him that sweet sentimental scene as well, that moment of, what does John Pertwee want on every show? A moment of, John Pertwee always insisted that in every script there's a moment of, you know, niceness for his character, some sweetness that comes out. And so that was there. So it had all the components of a John Pertwee script, just done really, really well.
Yeah. There's only one plot point that sort of stuck out at me a little bit, and I kept thinking about it, because there is an alien menace there who is looking to take one of the Earth's elements, and they were never really addressed the fact that particular element, which is a cause of pollution, is bad. Lots of it's bad, but we do need some of it. And no one sort of mentioned the fact that we need some of this stuff.
Yes, you're
right.
But
they kept talking like they were taking all of it. and even the Doctor didn't say, hang on, we can't take all of it. And that would have been a big motivation for stopping the alien threat as well. But anyway.
Maybe that's deliberate, because always in John Pertwee's stories, there was some bad science.
Okay, there's your bad science.
Yeah, you know, the Silurians were badly named, and etc. But even the Master driving around in a limousine, it was sort of, it conjured up so many images of all those John Pertwee shows that I think part of the reason I was so engaged was because they were using elements throughout, that they'd used throughout all the TV shows. I could picture the Master getting in and out of the limo. I could picture,
yeah,
because I've seen it all so many times.
I was exactly the same. It wasn't just the voices, it was the way it was written too. Yeah. So, I mean, Trevor Baxendale, legend.
Even the sets. I mean, you know, the nuclear power station, I saw it. I knew exactly what it looked like. It's nothing like a real nuclear power station, mind you, but the set with the big doors. I mean, yeah, I could visualize it all.
So I know there's only 3,000 limited edition sets been made, but it is available on download for everybody. So if you haven't yet purchased your standard edition, I would certainly recommend getting the limited edition, because it includes Terror of the Master, and hopefully one day down the track they'll release Terror of the Master as a separate release, because it's definitely worth its own release too. But one day, we want to sell some limited editions first.
Yep.
Okay, anything more about this set you want to talk about?
No, it's great. Get it. It's great to start the year with an event piece, and this is an event piece. There's some more good stuff still coming this month, but it was good to chat about this event piece. So I'm glad we did this. Thanks for the chat.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, let's go into some recommendations, shall we?
Okay. What have you been listening to, Dwayne?
Okay. What I've started listening to is, we've got a short story of mine coming up. So I'm very frightened. I'm very scared. So now I know what the writers feel like. But I've been listening to some other short stories as well. Non-Doctor Who stuff, but from an author that I really love from Doctor Who, Rob Shearman. So I've been listening to Love Songs for the Shy and Cynical. And there is a free story. The book itself, you can't even get the book anymore. I tried getting it because it's got a dozen or so short stories in there, maybe more. But the audio version's only got six of those, so about half the book. And the first story from that set is called Love Among the Lobelias. And if you haven't heard that, jump on the Big Finish website and listen to that now. You will listen to that now. We're in master territory here. It is absolutely fascinating. It's Rob Shearman, he's a bit of a hero of mine when it comes to storytelling and writing something that's so unexpected and so different to anything. I just would love to write half as well as he could write. So yeah, that's my recommendation. Love Songs for the Shy and Cynical. But the free story from that is Love Among the Lobelias. What about you, Philip?
Well, I know we usually audio. I'm actually going to recommend something Doctor Who related, but not audio. It's actually going to be a TV show. And it came out, I think, 2019. So it is actually old. But I just caught it recently on SBS. Well, one of our Chase Out one of our channels out here is a channel called SBS, and they're free streaming. And it's the TV show Years and Years. So it's by Russell T. Davis. It has lots of Doctor Who actors in it. And the show actually starts in 2019, but then moves us 20, 25 years into the future. And so it keeps jumping forward, and with Russell T. predicting where the world's heading. So looking at where we currently are now, where we're going to be in 4 years' time, in 8 years' time, in 10 years' time. And it is a bleak, depressing view with some hope. But on the whole, it's just, it's really fascinating where he sees technology going and where he sees people going. But brilliantly acted, amazing storytelling. I think it's only 6 episodes, but it's really worth a watch. So you'll find it on some streaming service, no doubt, but really worth watching. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah. I saw it a fair while ago now.
Right.
It's pretty dark.
I just binged it 2 weeks ago. Just in the holidays, I was just having a bit of a look what was around and available and saw it and went, I should watch that. And I was just captivated by it. So Russell T. Davis is an absolute genius.
He is. He knows. He's another writer who knows. He knows how to write and capture the general audience in an original, exciting way.
Yeah,
that's what he did with Doctor Who. So that's why we've got a lot to thank him for with regard to Doctor Who.
Oh, that's for sure. You know a character within 2 or 3 lines. He just is so clever with his words. So anyhow, that's my recommendation.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you very much. Okay, so do return next time to the Sirens of Audio for episode 42. And this is the big announcement. Episode 42 will be our Douglas Adams feature. We're going to have a closer look at a Doctor Who story called Doctor Who and the Cricket Man. Not the book, but the audio book, which is read by Dan Starkey. And I haven't heard the whole book yet, but have you heard any of it yet, Philip?
I have started it. I've got some homework to do before next week.
Lots and lots of homework. We might talk some Hitchhikers as well. I'm going to listen to Hitchhikers series 2.
We are definitely doing some Hitchhikers as well.
Yeah. And Dan Starkey, if you haven't heard Dan Starkey's Tom Baker, you got to hear it. It's fantastic. So that's for episode 42 coming up next time. Anything else you want to mention, Philip, while we're here?
Nope. Stay safe. Okay. Stay well.
Stick around after the end credits for my story perception filter. And if you send feedback, Please be nice. Philip's, you know, he's critical enough for all of you. So I only want the nice ones. That's all from the Sirens of Audio today. So it's all from me.
It's all from me as well.
You have been listening to the Sirens of Audio, episode 41, Masterful, a review with Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. You will rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. Theme music by Husky by the Geek. You will write to us at sirensofaudio@gmail.com. Our webpage is sirensofaudio.com. You will bookmark it now. You will follow our Twitter handle at Audio Sirens. You will join our exclusive Facebook group by searching for the Sirens of Audio now. And until next time, you will constantly listen to audio drama or be cut down to size, because we are the masters at telling you how much audio drama
Raw! We'll be right back.
Doctor Who, Perception Filter, by Dwayne Bunny. The casket was lowered into the ground against the backdrop of mournful music. The sniffles of snotty noses and the patter of raindrops gently falling on umbrellas and grassy earth could be heard inside this bubble of sadness. The rose petals, however, fell silently as each mourner took turns in throwing a handful down. Some appeared to be so light they began to float back out of the grave. Others appeared to fall with the weight of a brick. But if you concentrated and looked at the rose petals out of the corner of your eye, you could see that they were all falling in exactly the same way and at exactly the same speed. The mourners offered their forlorn condolences to the widower and to his children. The dearly departed had had a long life filled with lots of adventure and apparently love. "She was such a lovely person. I'm so truly sorry for your loss," said one to the widower. "She cared for me so much. She was like a mother to me," said another, leaving a visible wet patch of what were hopefully tears on his shoulder. The children, who were no longer children but still called children for the benediction of the funeral and for the comfort of their father, also received expressions of condolence from the mourners. "You must miss her so much. She was so wonderful," said one to the brother. "You'll get through this. The memory of her goodness will make you strong," said another to the sister, while the sister tried to tactfully avoid contact, realizing that the person had just left something other than tears on her father's now glistening coat. Tears flowed, sniffles, quivering voices, the sound of a quiet dirge. And then, post-funeral nibbles and drinks, cups of tea and mixed sandwiches cut into quarters, an old collection of home movies on the television, a collage of old photographs. Reminiscences provoked occasional chuckles, and the tears became more for the happy memories than the feeling of loss. The brother and sister had always been close. They hadn't had a chance to talk alone since their mother died. They had lived so far apart for so long. It was time to seize that chance as they arranged for their spouses to take care of the children, and they slipped quietly away from the gathering. They found their favourite old bookstore connected to a cafe. Or was it a cafe connected to a bookstore? It didn't matter. It was close by, quiet, and there was nobody else around. They both needed to talk, and they both had similar things to say to each other. "I have to ask you, Gillian, was I imagining things today?" asked John. Gillian shook her head as she took her first sip of tea. "Did any of those people actually know our mother?" "I was a little gobsmacked myself," said Gillian. "Am I going completely mad, or are we the only ones who know that Mum was one of the most horrible people to have ever walked the face of the planet?" said John. "I know. I wish I'd known Mum in the way everyone else had seen her. I'm confused. It's hard to work out the truth about her in my head. She was just..." Gillian struggled for words. "Just so awful. She was the only Mum I had, and I loved her, but I just feel so broken. I don't know what's true anymore." John sighed. "It makes you question your own reality, doesn't it? It makes you wonder whether her psychological abuse and her selfish behaviour actually happened at all, doesn't it?" Gillian looked into her brother's eyes. "It did happen though, didn't it, John?" "It did. But you try telling that version of reality to anyone else who was at the funeral today, and they just won't see it. To them, and especially to Dad, she was utterly flawless. It will never cease to amaze me how fooled people can be by someone who doesn't want their true self to be seen." Gillian drew a sharp intake of breath. "We can never say this to Dad. He's just so heartbroken." "I know. He might end up so heartbroken he joins us soon." "Don't say that. How can you be so cold about it, John?" "Yeah, I know, sis. I'm just cynical, that's all." Gillian bowed her head and said, "I do agree with you know. I just can't believe she's really gone. I feel like I had so much to say and now I'm never going to have the chance to say it." "Would she have listened to you anyway?" asked John. "I suppose not." Gillian looked up at her brother, but he wasn't paying attention to her. He was looking intently at something over her shoulder. "Gillian, we used to come to this shop all the time. Have you ever noticed that blue cupboard over there?" Gillian turned around but could only see the same bookshelf she'd always remembered. What blue cupboard? She asked. Still staring, John said, I hardly noticed it myself, but I caught sight of it out of the corner of my eye. Then when I looked closer, it almost jumped out at me. Take another look. Gillian turned, more slowly this time. As her eyes moved across the rows of books were all she could see. That is, until she caught a flash of blue. Her eyes darted back to the source of the colour, and there it was, as blue as could be. How could she not have seen it? It took up a whole section of the wall. They both continued to speak to each other, but they did so without taking their eyes from the cupboard. I know I've never seen it before, John, but I get the feeling it's always been there. Deja vu, remarked John. Yeah, I get that a lot. It's nothing unusual. John's voice trailed off. He and his sister were looking at each other in the eyes, but they had a flicker of understanding between them. They had both seen it, out of the corner of their eye. Their heads both flicked in unison to see what the flash of red had been, and they saw it clearly now. There it was. Leaning against the table next to them was an umbrella. Now, you may be thinking that umbrellas are pretty standard items, but this one was different. The handle was red, and it was in the shape of a question mark. Their eyes both now darted to see a pot of tea steaming away on the table, and almost in an instant they looked up at the man who had obviously ordered the cup of tea. He was looking right at them and smiling. When he saw them look into his eyes, he raised his hat and said, Hello. John and Gillian could feel their hearts racing in their chests. This man hadn't been there a moment ago, had he? They were sure he had not been there, but something was making them feel that he had been there the whole time they had been sitting there. I hope I'm not disturbing you, said the strange little man. I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. He held out his hand. I'm the doctor. Please accept my sincere condolences on the loss of your mum. John stared down at the doctor's hand. He felt frozen to the spot and could not speak. Gillian reached out and gently took the doctor's hand. Thank you, doctor. That's truly kind of you. Still smiling, the doctor leaned back in his chair and took a sip of his tea. Of course, I heard everything you said about your mother, said the doctor quietly, steam moving around his lips as he spoke. The two shot a quick glance at each other and John tried to explain their conversation. Well, you see, it was just that she was... The doctor held up his hand. It's all right. You don't need to justify your feelings to me. His face dropped and became more intense as he said, But you may need to justify your feelings to yourselves. After all, that's why you two needed to come here alone, away from everyone else who attended the funeral, isn't it? Gillian realized that she was squeezing her brother's hand so hard that her fingertips were white. The strange little man who had seemed to appear next to them like a magician was right. Perhaps it would be good to confide in this stranger. You're a doctor, right? Asked Gillian. The doctor reassuringly nodded his head. Then yes, you're right. We can't seem to understand the truth about Mum. She was so horrible to us. Horrible? Prompted the doctor. Well, yes, continued Gillian. I could tell you plenty of stories about what she did to make us feel worthless as children, as parents, and as human beings. And that makes her horrible? Asked the doctor. You don't think so? Asked John. But you loved her, didn't you? What kind of people does that make you, loving someone so horrible? I know, doctor, said John, his voice quivering ever so slightly. That's why we came here today. So many people said how wonderful she was, and we're doubting what we thought was the truth. Did we imagine what she did to us? Do you think you imagine what she did to you? I don't know, said John. There's simply something not right here. Something must be true or false. Something must be real and something imagined. We can't all be right about her. Can't you? Asked the doctor, leaning towards them enigmatically. John and Gillian were lost for words. What they had experienced in life told them one thing was the truth, then others had told them things that were the complete opposite. They were frozen in this moment, both verbally and deep within their soul. The doctor took a quick final sip of his tea and suddenly jumped out of his chair, picking up his umbrella. Come on, he said, offering a kind hand to Gillian. Both of you. Come with me. I want to show you something. Gillian hesitantly took the doctor's hand and stood up. John was not so easily led. As he began to protest, the doctor said, "It's all right, John. It's just over here. These blue doors had you two flummoxed a moment ago." John rose from the table and followed his sister and the doctor to the doors, who was now fumbling in his pocket. John looked at the panels at the top. They read, "Police Public Call Box." But before he could ask any more questions, the doctor let out a cry of glee, held his key in the air and slipped it into a keyhole. Immediately, the blue panels, which John could now clearly see were doors, opened, and the doctor led Gillian through. The doctor turned back to John and beckoned, "Come along, John. You'll want to see this." John and Gillian were in a different room now, a vast room, frightening yet comforting, foreboding yet calming. Gillian was the first to speak. "It's like a cathedral," she said. The doctor turned to them both. "Aren't you going to say it's bigger on the inside? I love that bit." John, still taking in his surroundings, said, "Bigger on the inside? What do you mean, doctor?" "Oh, of course," said the doctor. "I've had the TARDIS parked to make it blend in with the bookshelf. It just looked like a pair of doors leading into another room. Well then, let's just call this my consulting room." By now, John and Gillian had reached the centre of the room. They were transfixed by the dials and switches on the multifaceted desk before them, the clicking and whirring noises coming from within it, and the single column rising from the centre of it, reaching to the ceiling. "What is this place?" asked Gillian. "I told you," said the doctor. "It's called the TARDIS. Today, I'm calling it my consulting room." The doctor looked back to where they entered the room. "We can go back through those doors and consult any time in history and any point in this universe, or any other number of universes for that matter." Gillian's eyes widened. "Are you saying this is a time machine?" "Time and space machine, my dear," corrected the doctor. John's mouth had just about started working again from the drop position it had been in from the moment he'd entered the TARDIS. "Are you insane, doctor? Why are you telling us this nonsense?" "Are you saying you can't believe what I've just told you about my TARDIS?" asked the doctor. "Of course I can't. Those doors just led us into this room you've got next door to the bookshop." The doctor reminded John, "A moment ago I heard you and your sister agree that you couldn't believe your mother was gone." "That's right, I can't," snapped John. "But she is gone, that's a fact," said the doctor. "I know," yelled John. "So you can accept the truth of something you find unbelievable at the same time," reasoned the doctor. John's brain was tied up in knots. He was feeling overwhelmed and frozen. He couldn't speak. Gillian walked to the doctor and placed a hand on his arm. "What was it you wanted to show us, doctor? Was there something else?" "Ah, yes, yes, yes," he said as he darted to the other side of the desk. "I want to explain to you two why I'm here," began the doctor. "Let us suppose that I come from another time and another world." He held up his hands. "Now, I know that's something I'm expecting you to believe at face value and rather more quickly than others who have come through those doors, but please, hear me out." John and Gillian said nothing. The doctor continued. "Far away in a long time from now, my people developed a technology called a perception filter. You saw it in action just now. You didn't see the TARDIS and me until we wanted you to. And then, out of the corner of your eyes, you saw us. I can see from your faces that you understand what I'm saying. This technology helps us to blend in with our surroundings. Oh, we have circuitry to disguise our machines, but even then we can still be spotted by a curious person who knows for a fact that something is parked smack bang where it's not supposed to be. The perception filter is an extra layer of technology that supports the chameleon circuit, the circuit that disguises the TARDIS, well, other TARDISes. It even works as a universal translator for those who spend time in its field of influence. It's a type of telepathic circuit that uses an incredibly special kind of fuel to function. And that fuel is empathy. "Empathy?" said Gillian. "Yes, empathy," said the doctor. "There aren't many places in the universe with as much empathy as an Earth-based bookshop. So many thoughts being shared and digested, understood and empathized with. But when you combine a bookshop with a cafe, the empathy of the bookshop combines with the empathy of friends over a hot beverage, and it becomes a super fuel depot. Our machines love it. They're like kitties in a ball pit. We simply park them at the shop and the telepathic circuits do the rest while I drink tea. Win-win." "And that's what you wanted to show us?" asked Gillian. "Oh, no, 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 no," returned the doctor. he beckoned. Come around here, you two. This is some of what I wanted to show you. As they walked around the strange desk in the centre of the room, the doctor continued, You see, when I heard you talking today, the empathy between you was surging. I could feel it, and I felt compelled to help you, just as the TARDIS wants to help. Standing next to the doctor now, Gillian and John looked at the panel in front of them. A rectangular section appeared open and deep, filled with a clear, bubbly liquid, thick like hair gel. Now this is the telepathic circuit user interface, declared the doctor proudly. I've recently had it installed into the console. He beamed at the two newcomers. They showed no reaction other than confusion. Why do you want to show us this? Asked Gillian. Well, it's not exactly what I want to show you, replied the doctor, but it will certainly help us to find what I want to show you. The doctor took Gillian's hands in his, and as he spoke, he looked deeply into her eyes. I want you to close your eyes and think hard about your mother, all the horrible ways she treated you, how she made you feel. I want you to think about how much you miss her, how much you've shut yourself off from caring about her, and imagine what you would want to say to her if she were here. And I want you to think about your love for her. Don't reason why, just feel it. Can you do that for me, Gillian? Gillian looked at her brother, then back at the doctor. She nodded. The doctor, his voice now much deeper than a moment ago, said, Close your eyes now, Gillian. She closed them and thought about her mum. Not allowed to sit on her father's knee from the age of 4. Not allowed any meaningful contact with her uncles, who were both now dead. The way she felt abandoned by her mum after her first miscarriage. So much so that she kept future miscarriages to herself. And much, much more. She felt the love and loss of a daughter for her mother. She would never see her again. She missed her so much. She felt a tear roll down her cheek and a coolness swirling around her hands. She could sense movement and more noise in front of her. Then the noise stopped. She opened her eyes. The doctor was standing next to her, smiling reassuringly. She looked down at her hands and they were in the gel-like liquid the doctor had called the telepathic circuit user interface. She was surprised that she didn't feel any surprise at her hands being inside the UI. She knew in her mind that her normal reaction would have been to recoil in shock and pull her hands free. But she was calm, and a wave of contentment flowed over her entire being. The TARDIS likes you, said the doctor as he gently raised her hands out of the UI. Gillian turned to John. What happened? She asked. John was incredulous. The mechanism in the column rose and fell for a minute or two, and there was a vibration in the floor. Apart from that, I don't know. We've arrived, said the doctor. Both siblings turned with questioning looks towards the doctor. Shall we see where we are? He said, grinning. The doctor walked towards the doors they had entered the room from. He turned back and beckoned them to follow. Holding hands, they followed the doctor through the doors. They squinted. Instead of being where they expected to be, in the dark and grey grizzled room of the cafe bookshop, they were now outdoors and the sun was shining bright. As their eyes grew more accustomed to the sunlight, they noticed they were standing in a garden patch of a suburban backyard. Tomato plants were thriving all around them, staked high and bearing gorgeous-looking fruit. Gillian, said John. She turned and noticed he was staring at the blue doors they'd come from. Instead of being part of the bookcase, it was now standing free as a kind of telephone box. I know I should be questioning my sanity right now, said John, but somehow I feel quite calm and accepting of this insane situation. Me too, said Gillian. That's the TARDIS telepathic circuit helping you along, explained the doctor. Now, shh, listen. They followed the doctor's gaze to the house just over the fence. The house had a pathway running along its full length, just on the other side of the fence. Around the back, they could see an outhouse and a laundry attached to the house. The backyard had its own little vegetable garden surrounded by lawns of brilliant green buffalo grass. To one side of the yard stood a magnificent jacaranda tree in full bloom with delightful masses of purple flowers. John and Gillian both gasped together as they realised where they were. This is Nanny and Poppy's house, whispered Gillian. John nodded. Nanny and Poppy, your grandparents? Asked the doctor. Yes, replied Gillian. The doctor thoughtfully pressed the question mark of his umbrella between his chin and his lip. From the front of the house, in the direction of the street, a little girl of about 4 or 5 ran around the corner of the house, down the path and toward the backyard. A tall, middle-aged man popped around the corner, following the girl with purpose. "Is that you, Simon?" called a female voice from inside the house. The man looked up towards the open window from where the voice had come and called out, "Yes, it's only us. We've had a lovely time at the park. It's a glorious day." "Oh, good, good," replied the woman. "Lunch will be ready soon. Your brother's due back at home shortly." "Very good," said Simon. Simon looked towards the direction in which the girl had run. He strode towards the backyard with a strange kind of intensity. The doctor, John, and Gillian quietly moved to where the jacaranda hung low over the fence, and they could clearly see the back of the house. "John, who is that man?" whispered Gillian. "I don't know. I've never seen him before." John thought for a second and quietly said, "Didn't Poppy have a brother? I tried asking about him once or twice, but no one would ever say anything." They all stopped and stared as the man walked towards the laundry. From within they could hear the faint sobs of the little girl. The man stopped in the doorway, covering the whole entrance with his large frame. "Come on now, Lulu," he said quietly. John and Gillian gasped and gave each other a knowing look. The little girl was their mother. "You need to stop that crying now and come up for lunch." The girl couldn't stop sobbing. "You know what will happen to your mummy if you tell her about our special game. You don't want your mummy to get hurt, do you?" Two more sniffles and the little girl stopped sobbing. They could see the man hold out his hand into the darkness of the laundry. "Come on now, Lulu. Let's go inside." The girl appeared out of the darkness and gingerly took the man's hand. He offered her a handkerchief. She took it sadly, dabbing her damp and swollen eyes and wiping it across her snotty nose. They moved towards the edge of the house and up to the side entrance. "Lunchtime, you two," called the voice from inside. "On our way, bub," said Simon. "Lulu's just kicked her toe. She's a bit upset." They entered the house. The voice could still be heard. "Oh, darling, you'll be okay after some nice warm lunch." On the other side of the fence, under the shade of the jacaranda, John and Gillian were transfixed. Gillian's eyes were watery and a tear fell down her cheek. John's lips were pursed tight and he was finding it difficult to contain his anger at what he'd just witnessed. His face red, he started to move towards the gate separating the properties, intending to confront the evil he had just witnessed. The question mark handle of the doctor's umbrella hooked onto his arm and held him still. "We have to be observers only, John. Now is not the time," cautioned the doctor. John turned sharply on the doctor. "Well, when is the time? How can you bring us here to witness this and then expect us to do nothing?" "I'm not saying you shouldn't be angered by this, John," said the doctor. "I truly am not. But this is literally not the time. It's the year 1950 and no one in this society is ready to comprehend this sort of evil. You must trust me. We're not here to stop what has happened to your mum." "Then what are we here for?" hissed John through gritted teeth. "Empathy," said the doctor. John and Gillian both understood. All these years throughout their lives and the life of their mother, a penny had been in the air. Now that penny had dropped. It explained so much. "Your turn now, John. Let's go," said the doctor as he made his way slowly and gently through the vegetable garden and back to the TARDIS. Gillian took John's hand and followed the doctor as she wiped tears away from her face with her sleeve. Inside the TARDIS, the doctor allowed John and Gillian a few moments to recover. They couldn't even speak about what they had just seen. He approached Gillian, put a kind hand on her shoulder, and looked her straight in the eye. "Now do you understand a little better why your mum was so obsessed with keeping male attention away from you? She didn't mean for it to hurt or confuse you like it did. She was trying in her own way to protect you." Gillian nodded. "Now, John, you know the drill. Come over here to the UI," said the doctor. "I'm not sure I can face something like that again, doctor," said John. "If you want to be at peace now that your mum is gone, you must, John. Come along now." John took a deep breath and let out a long sigh and followed the doctor to the UI. He took hold of the doctor's outstretched palms. "Now, John, close your eyes. I want you to think about how horrible your mum was to you, how she made you feel, the way her treatment makes you despise yourself. I want you to think about how much you love and miss her too. Now." John closed his eyes and thought about his mother, how embarrassed he was by her intensity in social situations, how she'd kicked him out of the house when he received bad school reports, and how badly she treated his girlfriend before they got married. He thought about her refusing to attend his wedding and how much anger he felt towards her, and her attitude to spending all her money, openly admitting that she wasn't going to let the kids get anything when she died. And then he remembered how she taught him to iron, how to cook and how to sew, and how he saw her face every time he did any of those things. He missed her so much. And then he opened his eyes. He looked down at the UI and his hands were still in the gooey liquid. He removed them and felt an extra sense of calm wash over him. The doctor was still standing by his side, smiling. "How was that, John?" asked the doctor. "Well, to tell you the truth, it was rather pleasant," said John. Jillian was standing close by too, and she asked, "Doctor, is there any way you can tell us where we are this time, just to soften any shock we might get?" "Yes, of course," said the doctor. He tapped and twirled some knobs and dials on the console and spun around a small TV monitor so they could see it. 1960. The decade is not quite swinging yet, but we're almost there. Fiddling with a knob on the TV screen, an image came into view. "It looks like we're in a school, an all-girls school to be precise. We should blend in perfectly. We'll look like teachers. Come on," said the doctor as he headed towards the doors. Once again, John and Jillian looked at each other, sharing the impossibility of all of this, and followed the doctor out of the TARDIS. All three of them were now standing in a corridor. Girls in school uniforms were bustling around them. Jillian looked back at the TARDIS, but no one around her seemed to notice it or be bothered by it. The doctor noticed his companion. "It's all part of the perception filter. At least I know it's working, more than I can say for the chameleon circuit." A teacher walked past them, head down in a folder. She looked up at the strangers and stopped. "Can I help you?" she asked. The doctor raised his hat in greeting. "Hello," he said. "We're from the Department of Education, just doing an annual review." "Oh, I see," said the teacher. "Is there anything I can help you with?" "No, no, we're just watching the hustle and bustle, seeing how everyone's getting about their day," said the doctor. "Well, if there's anything you need, just ask," said the teacher as she put her head back into her folder and walked on. The doctor raised his hat in thanks. He noticed that John and Jillian were staring through a doorway into another room lined with tables. There was a servery at the opposite end of the room. It was the school canteen and dining hall. "What are you two staring at?" asked the doctor. "It's Mum," replied Jillian. "She's sitting over there," the girl with the hand over her mouth. Thinking quickly, the doctor said, "I can see there's no one in the servery. Let's see if we can find an entrance to it from the side." They walked around the side of the dining hall until they found the door they were looking for. Lunch period was almost over, and there was no one in the kitchen area of the servery. They soon discovered they could observe the dining hall from their position, and their mother, Louise, was close enough to be heard. How they longed to speak with her. Three other girls came into the hall and surrounded their mother, her hand still covered her mouth. One of the girls spoke. "Come on, Lulu, show us your moustache." Louise sat looking up at them, mouth covered. One of the other girls pulled her hand away, and there, between her top lip and her nose, was a light brown fuzz of hair. Puberty had darkened the hair on her face, and she was obviously devastatingly embarrassed about it. All three of the girls laughed. "Lulu," said one of them, "I think we'll call you Momo from now on." The girls roared with laughter. Another reached out to touch Louise's face. "Oh, let me give it a twirl, Momo." Lou smacked the girl's hand away. The girl switched instantly from laughter to intimidation. She slapped down her palms on the table, making Lou jump, and got nose to nose with her. "Now, there's no need to be like that, Momo," growled the girl threateningly. Time seemed to freeze. The two girls staring into each other's faces, one girl in anger, the other in complete terror. The school bell rang out, shaking everyone out of their frozen moment, and the three girls left Louise alone at the table. On the way out of the dining hall, one of them sent a chilling threat. "You'll keep, Momo. You'll keep." The laughter from the three bullies could be heard from the hall as they made their way back to the classroom. Louise sat silently, red-faced and quivering. Her eyes glistened as she struggled with all her might to keep it together. She rose and slowly made her way out into the hall. Jillian moved to give her mother some comfort, but once again, the umbrella with the question mark handle was used to stop one of them from acting. "No, Jillian, now is not the time," said the doctor. "I just don't understand," said Jillian. "I can never imagine Mum being bullied like this. I can imagine her being the bully, but never this. John remembered. You remember Mum always used to bleach her upper lip? I do, said Gillian. We would often call it her white moustache, said John. She hated it when we said that. I never quite understood why. Now, do you understand a little better? Asked the doctor. Gillian nodded. Do you understand a little better why she was strangely intense in social settings? Making sure everything had to be utterly perfect, especially the way she looked? Once again, Gillian nodded. But then a thought came to her. I can see Mum had these terrible things happen to her, but why does that mean she had to be so horrible to us? Wouldn't she want to make our lives better than hers? Once more, the doctor held the question mark handle to his chin and thought for a moment. Some people can never break the chain of harm. Your mother comes from an era in Earth's history that ignored so many evils. The victims of those evils were ignored or disbelieved or simply overlooked, left to handle whatever damage was done to them alone. She was likely unconscious of the reasons why she treated you the way she did. But you don't come from that era. You have a better capacity to see people for who they really are. See your mother now. See her without shining your own mirror of ideal motherhood against her record. And most important of all... Well? Asked John. Forgive her, said the doctor. Seeing the protestations forming in their eyes, he continued. The forgiveness isn't for her benefit. It's for you. Forgiveness is not about letting someone else get away with doing something bad. Forgiveness is about you making a conscious decision to not let those bad things affect you anymore. You must let the bad things go so that you can go on living. The cafe with a bookstore attached, or was it a bookstore with a cafe attached, was keeping its patrons safe and warm from the grey, pattering rain outside. Three customers sat near a window sharing a pot of tea. An umbrella with a question mark handle was leaning against the table. Well, Doctor, said John, I must say I'm still feeling exceptionally calm considering how ridiculous all of this is. That'll be the telepathic circuits giving you a warm dose of acceptance and contentment, replied the Doctor. He rose from his chair, picking up his umbrella. Well, I think the perception filter should have a full tank of empathy by now. Just remember, there's often so much more to experience than truth or lies, black or white. Our own perceptions are often filtered with the wrong type of fuel. Bad experiences from the past, hurt feelings, anger and injustice. To have our own perception working properly, we need a good, healthy dose of empathy. I hope you too have a little more than when you came in here earlier. John held out his hand and the doctor shook it. We certainly do, Doctor. Thank you. Gillian threw her arms around the doctor and squeezed him tightly. He teetered slightly under the force of the cuddle but regained his step. Thank you so much, Doctor. It was good visiting your consulting rooms, but somehow I don't think you're the kind of doctor we initially imagined you to be. The doctor held a finger to his lips. Shh, don't tell anybody, he implored. They all giggled happily for a few moments. Then Gillian said, You seem to know what we needed today, Doctor. Have you been through this too? Oh, yes, said the doctor. But it's a little more difficult to forgive the person I need to forgive, he said mysteriously. Oh, why is that? Who is this person? Asked Gillian. Myself, said the doctor. Slowly, the doctor turned and walked towards the bookshelves behind them. Before he disappeared, Gillian and John caught a glimpse of blue amidst the rows of books just out of the corner of their eyes.